Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
That's another one of those things that they don't teach you in film school is that day where you're all set to do this cool scene and you're talking to the actors and then all of a sudden you go, oh, I guess we should discuss the idea that you're going to spit into his face. And there's everybody like...
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Scher from CinemaSins.
Hello!
And Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
And today we've got two special guests, two directors of a movie called Becky coming out, I believe, June 5th?
Correct.
Is that what I was... June 5th. Yeah. We have Jonathan Mallott and Carrie Mernion here.
Yay!
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to come on. We love talking to directors on the Sincast and everything, and trying to figure out your process and your thoughts and all that. And we've all watched the movie Becky, and it's immediately stands out for several reasons. Like, I don't even know where to start. But I think we should start with Lulu Wilson, because not only is she the title character, but how do you get a child actor to the place that she's in this movie?
Well, we were extremely lucky because, we got to work with the amazingly talented Lulu Wilson. If you've seen her in anything else, you kind of know that she's special and is going to become a massive, massive star at some point, because from the time she was, tiny and working in horror movies like Ouija, up through some of the more recent stuff, you just see that she has a level of maturity and a talent. That combination in someone her age is so rare, and to be able to work with someone like that in a movie like this. The movie doesn't work unless you can have someone that talented holding it all together. On a technical level, it's really difficult to film with child actors because you have so little time with them on set, especially at night. There was some days where we were doing the night shoots and we had probably less than 3 hours to work with her. So that creates all kind of complications where we would be filming her coverage on one side of a location. Then, of course, over the course of the scene, she moves to the other side of the location and we do all of her coverage. And then she goes and we have to go back to the beginning, reset the cameras in that, do the opposite side of the conversation. We would do then Kevin James's coverage, but without her, with a stunt double, over the stunt double's shoulder. And it's just complicated. It makes things like remembering eye lines, the most basic, simple things that when you're doing normal coverage is pretty straightforward and simple. It adds a level of complication and kind of hesitation at 3 a.m. when you're exhausted and trying to figure things out. But she made it so much. She made it doable, really. And that goes from that technical aspect all the way to the more emotional and the real hard part, which is her conveying that she is either terrified or sad or any number of conflicting emotions that we forced her to do.
Or pissed off.
Oh my God. She can get pissed off and it's terrifying. But then the minute the camera stops rolling, she's laughing, playing with the dogs and having a great time. So we're lucky that we're behind the camera because I don't know how she does it in front of me.
I was actually about to ask because it seems like an extremely physical performance, but you are also cutting. I knew that you had a stunt double somewhere in there, but like, it still feels like she's doing a lot of physical stuff in this, even though she's got a double. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It was almost like, the stunt double was used a lot, as John said, more as like a stand-in for when we didn't have Beck, we didn't have Lulu around. But you see, Lulu's doing like lots of that stuff. I mean, she's jumping on the backs of guys. She's running through the woods. She's up on her fort. I mean, so is she actually? We had to kind of like stop her from doing things because, you know, there's certain rules. But she would have done everything if she could have.
Yeah, it reminds me of like young Chloe Grace Moretz when she's in Amityville Horror and she's on the top of that roof and that's like actually her on top of the roof and they had to like restrain her because, you know, like, look, you know, we got to make this safe and everything.
Yeah. She kept on asking us, can I do this? And we'd have to, talk with the stunt coordinator, kind of see what can be done. And it was always like this, like, where's the limit of the things. And, you know, we wanted it to feel like, because she was 13 and because the character's 13, like have that be as real as possible, but keep it safe.
Yeah. If you've gotten somewhat through this interview and wondering what this movie's about, I almost classify this as like teenage girl Die Hard, which makes it sound horrible. but it's like Die Hard. This movie's like Die Hard.
Yeah. That's one of our favorite movies. So we love that reference. The short pitch that we like to give is that it's a ultra violent Home Alone with a female 13-year-old girl protagonist. But one of the ones we've heard in the last few weeks is a slant on that, which we love too, is Home Alone with a little bit of cocaine and Rambo.
Yes.
It also weirdly, I kept thinking of Straw Dogs while I was watching
it. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a Don Coscarelli movie from the 80s called Survival Quest. And that was one that kept popping up in my head. But yeah, no, it was a very cool mashup of all of different types of genres, which is always fun. Survivalist horror is actually one of my favorite types of horror.
Another movie that we always reference for tone is Green Room. It's not in terms of like obviously the story, but like the being caught in a place and, you know, like kind of starting off in a you know, it's a band of people kind of that you wouldn't think they would have to. They weren't trained. They're just kind of like regular people who are put in a situation where they have to fight their way out of it. And this is kind of that situation where, you know, Becky, you know, she's not Hannah who had been trained by for her whole life by her dad to fight people. And she's just like a regular girl who has, you know, some emotional problems, you know, based upon some parts of her family of what happened to her family. And now she's pushed to the brink of doing something that she, you know, doesn't want to do, but has to do. So I think that's, you know, that's this Green Room kind of has that kind of sense of these people pushed to the brink. They have to do what happens in that movie.
Well, and they're also Nazis.
Yeah, neo-Nazis, I was going
to
say.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, that's the main, the other main thing that you're going to have questions about with this movie is the casting of Kevin James as a Nazi.
And remember, like, seeing Patrick Stewart as a Nazi in Green Room and how, like, how he played that and, like, how surprising that was. And, you know, the character of Dom in our movie with Kevin James is a completely kind of different character, but we still thought there was, like, you know, having Kevin be that charming, charismatic kind of person who can draw you in to his world and then flip it is something that was really interesting to us.
Yeah, it's always frightening when you see somebody who is, this is King of Queens and Hitch and everything, and then you see a darker side out of them, like you used to see with like Robin Williams and people like that. When you'd seen them so in so many comedic performances and everything, how did the casting of Kevin James happen?
It's kind of a weird roundabout, atypical story for in terms of casting. But just to touch on what you were just talking about, it's too bad that maybe at a drive-in we'll be able to see some reactions, but it is the type of thing that we kind of wish we could have seen in the theater. The faces go from, oh, there's Kevin James, to like, holy shit, what the hell is Kevin James talking about? He's a racist motherfucker.
I mean, the first shot of him in prison when he takes the hat off is just like, oh shit, that's a different type of thing here.
It's legit. Yeah, right away, you know. So in terms of the casting, it was we feel a little funny talking about it because it was weird. It wasn't just like, oh, we want Kevin James. We always knew it was going to be Kevin James. Let's go get Kevin James. It was more that we knew we wanted to kind of cast against type, and that's why we originally were talking to Simon Pegg. So it, you know, it's out there, and you can read about that he was on board to star in this. But due to some scheduling conflicts, he had a fallout. And in that time, we had already cast Kevin as the father, Becky's father, the role that Joel McHale ended
up playing.
So basically, Simon bailed out or had to bail. And Kevin, who was already talking with us, was like, hey, you know, I've been reading this script and I really love this role. You know, what do you think? So that kind of opened up the dialogue. And since it wasn't, you know, if you kind of do a mental shift from what we were thinking with Simon and to put it on Kevin, in terms of roles they've done before, it was a very cool shift. Especially when you think of, how Kevin looks, you know, that he had shaved his head, you know, he has this gigantic beard and he does have a level of physicality, that he could bring to the role. So we talked to him and we got on the same page tonally. Immediately, we're just like really excited about everything that he could bring to it. And he, you know, immediately wanted to peel back the character a bit, peel back some of the dialogue, really simplify it so he could, you know, play it in an understated, play it more through the performance rather than just a lot of dialogue and spouting stuff, even though he still says a bunch of crazy stuff, which is awesome. he was really on board with, making it more about the subtle performance. No, he was even involved with, picking out some of the tattoos. You know, we love collaborating, and especially with something as sensitive as that, we weren't just about to be like, here, put this gigantic tattoo in the middle of your forehead and that's the end of the story. We definitely talked to him about all those crazy symbols that he has all over his body.
Well, and that tattoo worked on a couple of different levels for me because it was creepy, but B, just the pain that character would have had to gone through to get that. Just the intensity of it. You know, you're just like, that just adds a whole other level to just how demented and how, you know, dangerous he could be.
You think about pain. There's a few moments in this movie where it looks like he's obviously impervious to pain. One in particular that stands out really from the entire movie. That is spectacular in a way to me. That's horrific. That's Evil Dead comic horror type stuff. And I just absolutely loved it. And also it informs the character. It says this guy is going to do whatever he needs to do to get the job done.
Yeah. And without giving too much away, that was probably the most I have ever laughed on a movie set was as Kevin James is, you know, going through take after take of working on this, without spoiling it, self-surgery. He was just screaming, and there were times where the surgery wasn't working, like the prosthetic was giving him trouble, and he's screaming and grunting. And exactly, we're behind the camera, like, you know, tears coming out of our eyes, trying not to just laugh our eyes out. But at the same time, you're wondering, wait a minute, is Kevin getting frustrated? Is he actually in pain? And so you're holding in all these emotions. And then finally, when we finally yell cut, he just, you know, lets out some typical Kevin James hilarity. And we all, the whole cast and crew just breaks down. It was such a fun moment.
But that was probably just run of the mill for him. I mean, the stuff you can only imagine Sandler's done to him. Some of
his movies. At any moment we're dealing with some pretty intense stuff here, and if he's not on camera, he's just, you know, doing something hilarious and trying to mess us up. So yeah, it was fun, but a challenge to stay focused.
But as you said, like it does deal with the character of like that he's so single-minded and what he's going to do and how he's going to get it. And you know, we talked a lot about control with his character, about him feeling like he had control. I mean, he'd been thinking about this for so long. He'd been in prison for, you know, over 10 years. And like, I'm going to go back and get this key. And this is how things will go. And then this little girl gets in his way and he slowly starts to lose control. And he's always trying to like keep that control and goes in and out. And that was like our job with Kevin to like work on that. Like, how does that control, how does that kind of break out and how does he keep it in? And that scene with them that we're talking about, like that was not going to let him get, that was not going to stop him. And he wanted to like get done with it and then move on and get what he was there for. So, I mean, it was a character moment mixed in with this kind of really, you know, intense physical pain that he was going through, you know, that Becky gave to him. And, you know, when we're talking about some of our favorite movies in terms of these revenge movies, and, you know, there's movies like Old Boy where, you know, he goes and he takes out the teeth of the guy who like kept him in his room. Like, we, you know, this is going to be, we want to be that intense with what Becky does to go after people that kind of came after her.
It's very easy to write a character like this too, as his racism is the only thing about him. And I'm kind of glad that we see that right off the bat, and it's not the only thing about his character. Yeah. We just know that, and it's not hammered into our heads over and over. I really appreciated that part of it and everything.
Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about family. I mean, he talks about, like, you know, he's created a family there, and his relationship with Apex is a huge part of, you know, and Apex's dealing with where he is in life is it's a big part of like why things are the way they are. And you know, Kevin, in terms of the character that he's building with Dom, he wanted to really kind of make sure that like there was a brotherhood there, and beyond the racism thing, it was like they've been doing this for this long, and now is the time to do this together. And it was like someone had betrayed each other, like they were brothers.
Yeah, yeah. That scene between him and, I guess, what, is the actor's name Robert Maillet?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yep.
He's in Pacific Rim. Yeah, he's really great.
He's terrific too. His character is pretty complex. You know, it seems like a lot of the piss has been taken out of him over the years, and he's willing to do this job, but you can tell it sort of that. I love that scene I'll call him by his character name. Dominic is telling him, you know, he's telling him that we've been doing this for, it'll be the last time we have to kill any kids. And he knows that this isn't the last time. It's never the last time. We're always looking for, you know, we're always looking for that. Whenever we have something in our way, we're going to do whatever we have to do to keep it that way.
Exactly. Yeah. That's such a great kind of, analysis of that, because I think, you know, Apex knows that there's never a last time with Dom, and Dom keeps on pushing him, and he's getting to that brink of what he can take.
And we love the idea that in the end, just the ambiguity of who actually is the bad guy, who actually is making maybe a more morally and ethically just decision towards the end. I think that we present some questions there, because you know, someone typically on the antagonist side starts making decisions that might be a little bit more ethically right, whereas someone on the protagonist side, you know, just has gone down that road of revenge and there's no turning back. But does the revenge in the end kind of justify the decisions that are made? So hopefully there's a little bit to digest as you're leaving the theater, and a little bit you can discuss and converse about.
And may I say that those role reversals are done in such a hilarious way, towards a specific part of this movie towards the end, It does have that subtext that you have there, but it's also will make you cry laugh at some point too.
Yeah, I was going to say the Apex arc is really interesting, and what you guys are kind of going off what you guys were talking about, I'm really curious as, because I feel that like when I was watching it, you almost had to do it the way you did, because if Apex is the main villain, then the movie's over in like 10 minutes, right? Because I mean, yeah. Robert is literally like the most commanding presence I've seen in cinema in a long time.
I don't know how
anybody could stop him. So I found that but then that worked so well for the movie itself, because God, he just nails that performance. I think he's a secret weapon. I'm glad you guys were able to get him in the movie, because he's awesome.
It's awesome because it's actually a really, really tough role to cast, because it was written as this, you know, really gigantic giant. And there's only so many actors that are really tall. And so, you know, when you're trying to cast somebody that fits that description, you have a very small pool of people to pull from. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, those guys just play thugs, you know, the silent thug or something like that. So to the minute we got we were actually Skyping with Robert for the you know, to see if he would be right for the movie. He just kind of showed us something almost more subtle and more reserved that we really love than most of the other guys that were just kind of big, almost like WWE, kind of like they had been doing something on a stage that they had to really overemphasize every movement and every bit of dialogue to the extent that it just got ridiculous. So he had a subtlety to him that was still, you know, like you said, can kind of command the audience, you know, the attention, while still just being like a face you can just stare at, because it is almost unreal. He is this gentle giant.
Apex is sad. I mean, he's sad and broken, and like so Robert had to internalize a lot of that emotion without saying a lot, and that's a very hard thing to do. It's one of the hardest things is to express something without having to say something, and he did an amazing job with that.
And just one more small thing with his height was that he is tall. He's about 7 feet tall, which is ginormous in anybody's standards. But ironically, we cast Joel McHale as the supposedly the kind of weak or like normal kind of dad. But it turns out Joel McHale is like 6'5", or, you know, he's ginormous too. And he lifts weights, and he's just this big buff dude. So we're lucky we happen to have one of the tallest actors working right now to offset Joel McHale.
Yeah, that scene between Kevin James and Apex, I was like, is Kevin James really that short? I actually he's like 5'8". He's perfectly normal height, but I was like, this guy is just towering over him.
Yeah, I mean, you can see to make that just give you a sense of scale. You could see when the Apex character would go through doorways. He would have to duck to get through the doorway. So, yeah, it's not that Kevin is obscenely short or anything. It's just that guy's really tall.
Mm-hmm. The other actor that we haven't discussed is Amanda Bruegel, who plays Kayla. She's great. Like some people out there may have seen her in Handmaid's Tale. But she's fantastic as well. And I think it's a great character to have in this. Especially when you have, you know, you have all the things that are swirling around in this movie. She's perfect.
Yeah, I think a great way to kind of summarize her was one of the first scenes we did with her was a very emotional scene where you know, a lot of bad stuff is happening, so she's kind of freaking out and crying. So just, you know, getting to the place like that with an actress is intense. You know, when you're on set and the actresses are crying or anyone's crying, it's intense, you know, because if they're really doing it, which she really was, you know, bringing her own tears up, it's not like they just push a button and the tears start coming. They really have to get to an emotional place in their head. And then that makes it so they're legitimately, you know, sad and they're legitimately crying. You know, it's acting. But it, you know, they have to get there if they're really going to do it. So she was getting there, and it was intense. And I think we had, like, it wasn't even a really a direction. It was just a conversation with her on set. Is that the idea that of course she would be crying and she would be sad because of what just happened, but we also want her to be strong. you know, we want to make sure that as the main Black woman in this movie, that she's represented as not someone who's just kind of swept away by all the actions and kind of a puppet in it, or, you know, has no agency. Is that throughout the whole thing, she's a strong mother, and she does the best she can with intelligence and a kind of a strength that only a mother can have. So in having that conversation with her when she was doing that first crying scene, she was just like, oh yeah, I got it. And was able to make that small tweak of in the performance to make sure that that strength came across through a scene where she's crying. You know, it's like, I can discuss that with an actress, but I don't know how I would implement it. So mm-hmm. to watch her take that note or that discussion and actually be able to execute it on the turn of a shot was really impressive.
Well, and speaking of Rambo, she kind of has a Richard Crenna, you're going to need more body bags moment. Her big scene with Kevin James when she's discussing Becky's.
She was so looking forward to that scene. And that was one of her, like, you just tell, like, she was like, I think she kind of built up to that. And then it was just, she just couldn't wait to, like, go face to face with him. And it was, one of the better scenes of the movie, I feel like.
It was awesome. That's another one of those things that they don't teach you in film school is that day where you're all set to do this cool scene and you're talking to the actors and then all of a sudden you go, oh, I guess we should discuss the idea that you're going to spit into his face. And it's everybody, like, now, I mean, I really don't know what we would do. I mean, obviously you would just obviously fake it right now with the pandemic. But even then it's kind of like, one of those weird conversations that you have to have as a director of, you know, are you okay? Can we really spit in your face? You know, and then telling the actress that it's okay to spit in his face. Mm-hmm. It was a good thing
you didn't cast Howie Mandel. I don't think you would have gotten that scene.
Yeah. I saw on Amanda's Instagram, she kind of posted something about the movie, and in the comments she said, like, her mom actually said, oh, I'm so excited for the movie. And Amanda wrote back to her mom on Instagram saying, I got to spit in Kevin James' face. she was so excited. And then I think her mom wrote back and said, what does that mean? Or it was like hilarious. But Amanda's like, you just felt like that's the kind of thing. She's super warm in certain parts, and then she's like super strong, and then she like gets the fight with Kat. Like, it was like a really fun part for her, and it was something that we hadn't seen from her yet either.
Yeah, she knows immediately what the situation is, and you know, Joel McHale's character is sitting there wondering, like, oh, well, if we just do what they want and we'll get out of here. And she's like, nope, that's not the way this thing works. And without spoiling this scene too, I love too when she has to swear in front of her son and then explain exactly. And when he calls her out on it, she's like, well, you know, this is why you do that and everything. It's a fantastic performance and character. It sneaks up on you because at first, you know, she's the other woman. She's the replacement mom or whatever, so to speak. And it could easily just end there because a lot of movies do that. Yeah. It doesn't do that here.
Yeah. We hopefully subvert that kind of character. And it is usually a character that you feel like, you know, what's going to happen, and it's not the way at all with her.
So one of the things that I've always wondered about is you both are directors on this movie. So how does that work? Is one of you better at one thing and the other is better at another thing? Or is it just, you kind of, I've got an idea, let me take the reins here. How does that work?
Well, obviously, I'm just better at everything. So,
mm-hmm. so there you go.
It's very, very clear.
There's the answer right there.
Okay,
that's
great.
That's it. Yeah. Next question. No, we've been working together for years. There was a point where I think when we got to 10 years of working together, I told Carrie, I don't think we have to tell the exact date anymore. Let's just say over 10 years. and now it's almost reaching double that. So, we've lived a lifetime together, and we kind of say we're like brothers in the sense that we can kind of go at each other's throats at times, but then turn around and forget it. You know, realizing that, you know, usually it's just in the form of our passion for the work. And, you know, we're both passionate, we're both directors. So, really what ended up happening was we realized that, for the sake of our relationship and for the sake of, the best thing for communication on the set is to have, one person lead, when we're on set. So what we do is we do a lot of prep. We do storyboarding, shot listing, tons of work even before that in terms of mapping out the characters and the arcs and really breaking down the script. And this is months and months of work before we even get on set. So once we're on set, we have one person lead, and that usually means, there's one person closer to the actors. They're really in the action on set next to the cinematographer, really dictating how the set goes in the normal sense of a director. And we have, we wear a Comtech in the ear. And so then the other guy is back at the monitors, and he's able to kind of assess the scene, from a more kind of calm standpoint, actually look at a big monitor, make sure visually everything is in line with what we've planned, and communicate. There's a lot of communication back and forth. And really we at that point, we trust the lead for the most part. And only when something really needs to be called the attention to, do we slow down the set and just elevate it. But for the most part, the lead kind of takes control with the support of the person back at the Video Village.
And at this point, we don't quite know how the singular directors kind of work, because, you know, you kind of have to sacrifice one thing if it's just one of you, because you can't, or it has to be very slow where you are on the set working with the actors, you call cut, you walk back to the bigger monitors, then you have, you know, replay to kind of see it. So it's, or you just don't see that, or you don't get to really actually, you know, see how things played out. So for us, it's kind of a good way to work. You know, it's obviously been happening for years and people can do it. But for us, it kind of works really well to kind of have these two sets of eyes in these two different places and make these kind of both very intense movies that focus on acting and the performance, and also focus on how it looks. Because I feel like we've heard directors say, well, I have to kind of like focus on one or the other. I have to like, you know, trust someone else to kind of look at the monitor, or I have to trust them. I have to trust the actors to do what they do because I'm back at the monitor, but we don't have to do that.
Yeah, I was just curious about that. And you guys have been doing it for so long now. Like you said, you don't even know what it's like to be by yourself doing it and everything. Yeah. It would be that's an interesting take because, 20 years, really.
Yeah, well, we met at school. We met we went to art school together. And so we went through school together. We then started working at, we had a whole business where we were doing graphic design and animation. We had a company where we had employees and working with clients to kind of make animations and films. And then we gradually started working together as directors, and that led to where we are now. But yeah, we've been together since college.
Wow. That's amazing.
Well, there was something. We both have gray hair. So, you know what that
is. Oh, yeah. I see your IMDb pictures, definitely. Yeah. There was something alluded to earlier in the conversation, but you said that you wanted to have people leave the theater thinking about stuff, and that's another thing I think that's good about this movie is that even though a lot of this can seem like fun and games with some gore mixed in. It does leave you at the end going, well, what happens to this person,
right,
after all of this? Mm-hmm. Because there's it's one of those things where I was like, I think most movies would probably end on some sort of like, well, we just don't know. But this actually kind of addresses that there might be some issues later. Was that just in the original script, or is that something that you guys kind of came up with?
Yeah, I think it's something we worked on with the writers. Cause, we originally got the script, we pitched to do the script, but when we pitched to make some significant changes. And, one of those was really working on the character of Becky and her motivations, and also, and her point of view. Yeah, really making this movie about her point of view. So I think that was one of the things that we worked on, was that ending. And we really love that idea of that. I probably don't want to discuss it too much, but because I think it is something nice to kind of get at the end. But we like the idea of that it's almost like Breaking Bad, where, you're still really invested in her character. But at what point is she really just getting revenge, or at some point does she start liking it? And if, you know, if it's the latter, how does that affect her moving forward? And what does that mean in terms of her rest of her life? And is she scarred, or is she just kind of flipped to the dark side or something? But we love that idea.
Yeah. Great part of it. Like I said, I have not typically seen anything like that in a movie, where you address the maybe psychological issues at the that are going on.
I mean, I think you have right. to. I mean, when you put this kind of this premise in with a 13-year-old girl, you have to address that. If we didn't, I feel like it'd almost be irresponsible to kind of like to say, okay, well, we're going to take this genre and just put it. And just change it into this, a young person, and not deal with how all this can affect them. Because then you're almost like being exploitative, I feel like. And I think if you didn't deal with that, then what's the point of doing a movie like this?
Well, you set it up beautifully too, because, one of my first notes that I wrote down is that, I've got a 12-year-old, so I've seen this quite a bit. It's a great representation of teen angst, even from the beginning. You see her interactions with Joel McHale's character, with her dad, and to where she's just, you could tell she's just got all this anger, and she's got all this psychological stuff from her environment and some from just being a teenager. Yeah. And yeah, so when you set that stage early on, the only time she smiles is when she gets out with the dogs, really. And then you can see after this series of events, absolutely, there would be some sort of effect, because she was already on some sort of a trajectory being a regular teenager with all this stress and emotion.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of those questions that some people have asked about. How does it even make sense for a teenager to get that crazy or react that way? And I think, like you're saying, anybody who's been around a teenager or a person that age knows how short their tempers are and how intense and unforgiving they are. It's not like a teenager just has the skills, the kind of relationship skills or the societal skills or any type of emotional skills to be able to, kind of take something and move on. It's like, we've all seen how that can play out, and it's just anger amplified.
Well, I don't want to spoil too much more. I could actually discuss a lot of other scenes in this, but then people who want to see this movie, may hear too much at that point. Anybody else, Jonathan, Barrett, any other questions you guys have?
I do have a question, because much like what you were talking about with Rambo, the environment plays a big role in here. So where did you guys shoot this?
Oh, we shot it in outside of Toronto in Canada, in the middle of nowhere. Oh my God! It did play a role between the insects and the snakes and the poison ivy. That's just one of the challenges of shooting on location, is that you kill yourself, location scouting and finding the place that can work the best and is closest to the script and sets the tone you want. And then you find out that it's surrounded and by poison ivy. So, so what do you do?
Poison ivy, you're like, oh wow, poison ivy. But it was like poison ivy. It was lining the floor of the forest with poison ivy, so that if you walked anywhere, you'd get it. And then we had to, you see, like, there's scenes where people are rolling around on the ground So we actually had to have a horticulturist come in, you know, find out where it is. And it wasn't just a little patch. It was everywhere. So it was like actually a pretty big deal to do that. And we were, you know, it was like we want to be authentic as possible. Like we want to feel like we were there and have this kind of messy, you know, woods. It wasn't some, you know, you saw all the branches everywhere. We wanted to feel kind of almost like scary in a way as you're around there. So it was a really kind of unique place to film that. And we were there for about 20 plus days, you know, with the
family. Oh, wow.
You know, we lived in a place that was close by, and we'd kind of come every day to the set and just kind of like and film our crazy little movie in this house.
But another funny little detail about the house, when we were location scouting, as per typical, you look around the house, and we walk into this empty abandoned house, which is actually was scheduled to be destroyed so they could build a new house. But you walk into the master bedroom, which was this sprawling, crazy looking open air bedroom that opened up to a gigantic master bathroom. And right in the middle of this whole room was a gigantic hot tub. So right away, we're kind of like, this is kind of an odd room. and then we keep looking, and we move away a bureau and find a trap door with a ladder down into some sort of basement secret room.
What?
So we were like, okay, what is this? And then you go down into the secret room, and there's soundproofing, and there was nothing, no furniture or anything left, but we could only imagine what had happened down there.
Oh, wow.
It's perfect for a horror movie. My God. Yeah,
but it was
In the funny term, we never actually show that room in the movie.
Oh, well, sure, yeah.
That would have just taken it into a whole nother direction.
The secret room is where Dom goes down in the basement, and where he goes up the ladder. So if you remember the scene where Dom goes to look for the key, and he goes to the ladder, that where he goes right there, that's where the trapdoor is to the bathroom of the main bathroom of the house.
Is oh my God!
Crazy or what?
That's some crazy shit, man.
Or wait, you guys don't have trapdoors in your master bathroom?
No. Maybe we do, but we don't know. We need to start moving bureaus.
The contractors asked if I wanted one, but I was like, no.
Because they're not really a basement county. There's not really basements around here.
Because the original script, what he was looking for was in the attic. And the house that we found didn't have an attic, at least one that we could go into. So we had to kind of move things around, and we found that room that had this trap door. And I was like, oh my God, we can use this crazy trap door that we cut to somewhere else in the house. But like, it was like, oh my God, this is like, it was exactly what we needed. And then even fucked up more than what we thought.
Yeah.
I rewatched Cooties recently. Which I enjoy. I thought it was interesting in a parallel in a way was that in Cooties, I guess semi-spoilers for a movie from 2014, you kill all the kids. And now we have a movie where all the kills basically are done by a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't know. It was an interesting coincidence, I guess, in a weird way for me.
Our next movie, we have to have either all the kids kill again, or we have maybe some like elderly people take over. Or animals.
Yeah.
Children of the Cocoon.
The way we talk about it is like Becky was one of the kids that got away from Cooties. So she was a kid. And then our second movie, Bushwick, we have Brittany Snow. She goes back. So we feel like Brittany Snow is the grown up version of Becky. So we're just following following that character as she grows older. So next thing will have to be, you know, a 30-year-old and a 4-year-old. Let's kind of follow all of her through her whole life in different scenarios, different genres, different scenarios.
I got to say, though, in Cooties, my one of my favorite moments in any film in the last decade, because we've all had that issue with getting the dollar bill in the vending machine to get that fucking candy bar. And you guys use that to create so much suspense. I mean, it's just, it's an insanely, it's a beautiful scene. And just like even the what Elijah Wood and Allison Pill have to do just to get to the vending machine. Just that whole sequence is just brilliant.
It was die hard in a school to get to the vending machine. That's what
yeah.
Nice. I would love, I mean, I honestly would love to talk more about it, but again, I don't want to spoil too much.
Yeah. We want to definitely save some suspense. So it is coming out June 5th, correct?
Yeah. It's this Friday, and it's going to be in almost 50 drive-in theaters around the country, a few hardtop theaters, and then on every kind of digital kind of platform that you, that we, you know, from Amazon, iTunes, and any kind of digital thing. It's kind of everywhere.
This seems perfect for the drive-in though. Like,
yeah,
I know you guys would obviously rather have it in theaters, you know, but this seems like a perfect drive-in movie.
Yeah. I mean, this is a Tribeca film. So, you know, when that got canceled, we thought let's do this. Let's get into digital. We thought that was a good idea. But then when drive-ins started to kind of be an option, we pushed really hard because we thought this is a movie that, you know, when we were young, we saw some of these kind of rated R thrillers that kind of really had a big effect on us. And we thought, you know, let's see if we can get this into some drive-ins and have that experience, you know, where you can drive up with your family and kind of watch it and have that experience. So yeah, we're excited about that.
All right, guys. We'd like to thank Kerry Murnion and Jonathan Mallott for coming on here and talking about this movie. It makes me appreciate it even more. And I was already a fan, and I appreciate you guys coming on here and talking about it.
Well, thank you guys very much. It was awesome talking to you. And it's always fun talking about movies. So
yeah,
absolutely. And next time you make one of these, you got to come back on and we can talk about it, because this one was super fun. I can't wait to see what you guys are doing next. Do you have something lined up that you're planning on doing, or are you focusing on the release right now and kind of mired in that?
We always got a bunch of things brewing. And basically the only thing we can really say right now is that if you like our brand of violent humor, that type of stuff, that you'll definitely like the things we have in the oven right now. Really intense, really, really wild rides.
Okay. Right. So you do have to come back on then.
Yeah, we will. Cause we're big fans of your podcast. So we'll definitely come back on. This is really great. Thanks so much for going.
I'm looking forward to your home slasher film. That's going to be exciting.
Oh, shit. How did you know?
Well, this is going to do it for this interview. I'd like to thank again Kerry Murnion and Jonathan Mallott. That's Chris Atkinson, Barrett Sharon, Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.